Good morning and good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. And I am Michael Connor, the CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, but more importantly, the host for Voices for Excellence. And this podcast episode is featuring one of the most dynamic educators, I should say, education transformers. She is a reformer at heart, but her work, right? Her work is just outlined by results. And we're talking about exponential high-level results in a really quick and accelerated time frame. So it is absolutely my honor to have, you know, one of my sisters. She is a D9 sister. Obviously, you know, she is a part of Zeta Phi Beta Sorority Incorporated, and I'm a part of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. So there's a lot of D9 love between Dr. Mullen and I. So Dr. Mullen, I am so happy to have you on this podcast episode.
Yay. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to join you today. This is exciting.
Absolutely. And just to give you a background on Dr. Mullen, I have known Dr. Mullen for quite a while because her work is underpinned in the New England area. She did work for the Department of Education for Rhode Island, where her turnaround results were just unbelievable, just phenomenal. Her redesign aspects for systems and structures, but more importantly, it was underscoring equity and justice, right? I always say that justice is that next level of equity. And then right now she is doing some phenomenal work as the assistant superintendent of student services for the Cambridge Public Schools for Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yes, Harvard, everybody. She's out there with them.
Harvard.
Harvard, right? Parking the car. Right. So that's where Dr. Mullen is leading her work. And again, wherever she goes, exponential gains and results and outcomes for students. So Dr. Mullen, we're going to start this fun podcast episode. But I always ask this first question, right? And this is from a mutual friend, a mutual educator that we respect, Dr. Tracy Davis.
Thanks for me.
Yes, we love her so much. Hi, Dr.
Shout out to Tracy. Yes.
She's getting shout outs already. But the question I want to ask you, right, Dr. Mullen, is what is your equity song that defines Dr. Barbara Mullen, right? When you walk into a room, what song comes to mind if I am a student, teacher, or education leader in the Cambridge Public Schools? But more importantly, right, I've heard you speak nationally in front of many, many, many educators ranging in different levels. But when they see you, Dr. Mullen, what is your equity song?
So I am going to go with, and this is, it's a little bit of a, it's a bit of a spin on the song, but I am an older millennial, which means that my parents' heyday was the 70s. So I grew up with a lot of 70s, and there's this baseline. It starts first with like this winds. The winds come in and you hear two men talking about how they're going to change the community. And like, man, do you really think we're going to be able to get the drug dealers and the pimps and the this and the crooked politicians out of the community? And the other man's like, man, I don't know. And then you just hear this bass line come in. And then you hear Willie Hutch, brother's going to work it out. Brother's going to work it out. So I changed it to sister's gonna work it out because, right, I'm working with some phenomenal sister superintendents, assistant superintendents, aspiring superintendents to really change the face of the superintendency and let them know that sisters are gonna work it out. Like Black women, women of color, women allies, we're gonna work it out, right? So that is my song, and it's got a really, really amazing bass line. So it's just a good song to walk into. You just want to come into a strong baseline like that. Willie Hutch, brother's gonna work it out.
I'm hearing the song right now, right? I'm writing all this down, and wow, sisters are going to work it out. But Willie Hutch and Dr. Barbara Mullen, woo! I mean, you want to talk about shattering ceilings? You're shattering walls, concrete walls with that.
Concrete. Yeah, really, that's it. That's from the Mac too, from the movie The Mac.
But Doc, let me go back to this, right? Sisters are going to work it out, right? You said
Yeah.
Black women, women of color, right? Leaders, right? When and this is a subvariant of a question, right? We need to see more representation, right, of women of color, right? Black women, brown women that are in leadership roles, but they need to stay in leadership roles, right? What is some of those approaches, right, that or strategies that you employ so that now you could continue to work it out despite the hardship and adversity as a Black woman leader?
Yeah, so I would say one of the things that plague women is this, I call it the slingshot theory. So like we have so many barriers that hold us back structurally. So patriarchy, racism, gender, you know, isms. And we feel we have to build our expertise more than anybody else in our male contemporaries or our Black male contemporaries or our other contemporaries with our across identities. So that then when we're in a space, we are like trying to show exactly what we know. We are almost hyper and overperforming. Excuse the camera acting crazy here. But we're overperforming. And so that burns us out. That does not allow us to sustain and do transformation work, which is, you know, while yes, there is some is acceleration needed, the slow burn is really what sees the results. And so that's one thing, right? Just this need to overperform, to overshow our expertise, what we know. The other piece that I've observed is really this notion of this notion that we can't be vulnerable, that we cannot say we don't know something because it's weaponized against us, that it's not, that we're not going to be able to show our cards. And you know, this work is very political, right? It's election day. And so there are school boards changing across the nation. There are governors changing across the nation, House of Reps across the nation. And we can't be naive in thinking that that does not impact us. So we're always on guard to think about how is the context going to change and how do we need to respond to it. But we also still need to be vulnerable and we need to be able to say, I'm not clear about this. Explain this to me. Show me this. Help me see your perspective more because I don't understand it. And so sometimes I think it really is about having that coming closer, leaning in, getting more perspective. We often have to take multiple perspectives all the time. It's one of our strengths. But I think from the guise of listening to lead and not listening to respond is always a benefit. And these are things that work for anybody, right? But I notice sometimes we feel that superwoman syndrome. Karen White said, I'm not your superwoman, okay? And that is what I tell women. You don't have to be a superwoman. We will work it out, but you know, we'll work it out together. So we have to lean on our communities. And that's what I would say is sustaining not only to women, but you know, there's this John Henry syndrome for our brothers, and they really need to understand that they can be vulnerable and lean on their communities too.
Absolutely. Vulnerability, you know, I think that is one of the inhibiting masculine type of approach that really not only just from a self-leadership standpoint, right, but from a broad leadership standpoint, that exhibiting vulnerability in the context of the work, in the context of advancing the work, me, I want to follow that leader, right? Because I know that leader cares. And you know, this whole thing of holding it in, not exhibiting vulnerable traits, having the leadership as a position, not a disposition, right? And that is exactly what you're saying. And I love what you said is listening to lead. Now, I want to kind of segue into the next question, right? Listening to lead, because Dr. Mala, I'm a fan of yours, because here's the thing, you know, I've heard you speak many of times across the country. We've engaged in some really deep, high-level conversation around Black students, right? And you made some historical gains for marginalized groups, all right? Because when you adopt and concretize a culturally responsive lens on all subgroups, including, students that are on the 75th percentile or 90th percentile, they gain as well. But your work, where we see some of the most historical gains with marginalized groups, with your turnaround work in Rhode Island, and now your current work as assistant superintendent of office services for Cambridge Public Schools. Now, as your work is always grounded in an equity lens, I mean, it's always grounded in an equity lens. That's what I love about you. Everything has to ensure that includes all. But a lot of people don't know what some of those baseline strategies are. So, strategies or leadership takeaways, did you learn? I want you to reflect now. Did you learn when you were doing expansive redesign efforts in Rhode Island and Cambridge? And just like you said, to underscore, right, is that you want your sisters, right? Your sisters are going to work and listening to lead. Put it from that perspective or from a gender equity standpoint.
You know, you at that was a lot. So I was like, okay, I got a response. Wait, okay, hold on. There's another
You
one.
know
There's another one.
how I am, Dr. Mullen,
Yeah,
right?
it's a
Ten questions.
tier, it's a tier question. So what I will say is this. There's a couple of like great catchphrases that people can write down when they are setting, I call it setting direction. So I did some really great work and what I would call what felt a lot like a fellowship at the Center for Leadership and Educational Equity. I took a brief stint outside of district executive leadership consulting and working with school districts in the Department of Education in Rhode Island. And that's where some of the most transformative work happened, and then pivoted back into the turnaround work. And some very deep work around setting direction and building capacity to lead, building capacity to monitor progress, building capacity to collaborate, reorganizing systems, and building capacity to teach. Those are the six core leadership practices for equity work, right? There's a lot to be said around setting direction. That's the biggest lift as a leader is where are we going, right? Without a vision, people perish. And so you have to set that and people have to believe it. And then the other piece is, equity is a tide that lifts all boats. So again, to your point, it is, and you'll love this, right? But it's where you start and it's where you finish. It's the alpha and the omega. It's like that's equity is where we begin and it's where we're going. And so I often tell people, I'm going to get in the weeds here. If you're looking to raise your achievement for students and you're going to just what we call move the bubble kids, okay, there's this group of kids. If we just do an extra intervention, if we do an extra or a one block, some strategic tutoring, we can push them over the bubble and increase our numbers, then you are not thinking about equity. Sorry, I know a lot of us like that strategy and it looks good on paper, but you're not thinking about it because that's not the inequity in your system. The inequity in your system, that's why when you look at my vitae, you see multilingual learners, students with disabilities, low socioeconomic students with high mobility, girls, boys, you see a very targeted universal approach because I need to start with the students for whom the system is not working, has not been working, is not designed to work for. And if I only go with the bubble kids, if I only go with the kids who are right on the cusp and we just knock them over into proficient or into, excelling, whatever your state accountability metric is, then I am going to see some marks, some gains for kids in our aggregate scores. But once I disaggregate it, which every, federal and state policy is moving to looking at that growth disaggregation as an accountability rating, you're still going to be locked out and lucked out because you are leaving a large group of students behind. And so when you start with the inequity, you start with disaggregated data. I pulled my principals together, my curriculum instruction team together, executive cabinet together, and I started with disaggregated data. And I said, we're not looking at the aggregate because at Cambridge schools, we look like lollipops, sunshines, and unicorns, right? We have a lot, we're Harvard, we have all Harvard professor kids, Russian math tutors, aggregate, we're okay performing better than the state. But once you break that down, is it okay with you that students with disabilities are at the 21st percentile? That low socioeconomic students are at the at the 20th percentile that multilingual learners are in the single digits, it cannot be okay. And so we're starting there because that system redesign is where it goes. And so the last thing I will say is, you know, when you're embarking on transformative work, there is a what I call a different reformula. So I grew up in the age of reform. You know, Paul Vallis was my CEO in Chicago. Arnie Duncan was the CEO as a teacher. Like, I got the reform kind of process down, and it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the way we've done it. We have to bring communities in. And so that outside-in approach with starting with folks closest to the problem, doing a continuous improvement, really breaking down where it is that you need to go with those folks, that's going to see some accelerated gains because you've reorganized the system, and you're going to see some sustainable gains. That's the piece, right? It's superintendent musical chairs in our nation right now. And you can't have a superintendent leave and all of the work leave with them. So those are some of the strategies, really thinking about your community and stakeholder engagement strategy, being clear about who is your target for improvement, whose outcomes do you want to improve the most, and then having a very clear plan of action, a strategy for project managing that work is really important.
Absolutely. And Dr. Mullen, actually to our participants, what many don't know is Dr. Mullen has a hidden talent regarding data, right? So full transparency, Dr. Mullen and I have some of the most geekiest data conversations regarding, you know, what I like to say, and I'm going to steal her words, reformula, right? Reform, transformation, because, I mean, when Dr. Mullen was talking about setting the direction, right? That strategic plan and strategic performance management, where now she even moved into it nicely, much more in a simplistic form than I would explain it, but that diagnostic analysis, right? Whether it be comprehensive or segmented, where you're looking at disaggregated data from a cluster analysis. So now you can be intentional with the work for all. But now, Dr. Mullen, right? You hit upon the 6 points, but the critical meta theme of building capacity, right? Bringing in a community, building capacity. I think that, you know, you and I had this conversation when we were in Ithaca during the summer, is that if we really want to have whole systems transformation, and this is, you know, words taken right from Michael Fullan, right? Whole systems transformation and identifying the right drivers, building human capital and social capital in this synonymous context. You have to have this leadership ability to move from restructuring to reculturing. I like to say that, right? Restructure to reculture. How do you now, from a strategic standpoint, because you really started outlining the whole strategic performance management process with the diagnostic of the root cause analyses, but more importantly, you got to build capacity in order for those systems and structures to work, right? Mm-hmm. Now, to create that shared model around restructure to reculture. How do you do that, right? Building capacity, where now in the AC stage of education, we move from whole child to whole school to whole community now. So where does that start?
Ooh, this is a good one. So I would say that, you know, there's a lot. I grew up so I talked about organizing when I was in Las Vegas and organizing dispositions for leaders. So really taking social movement strategies and applying that to your work as a superintendent or as a building leader, right? A classroom leader. And what are those organizing strategies? And one of the biggest strategies for organizing is building the capacity of the people to be evangelists for the cause. Right? Like, you go door to door, you knock, it's grassroots. You're like, hey, you know, you go to, it's actually really serendipitous that the affirmative action cases are in the Supreme Court right now, because that is the first march I ever went to when I was in seventh grade, and California had Proposition 209 to approve affirmative action. I was like on the Capitol marching. I had no idea why. My dad was like, look, I'm going to set you down. This is what we're going to do. You're going to get this sign. It means this. You want to college at me. And so he built my capacity to move work forward. For him, as a higher education administration, it was directly connected to his practice, right? It was directly connected to him as an administrator. But I was an end user. I had no idea as a seventh grader what that policy would mean for me, but he needed to bring me along. And so when we're advocating for something as practitioners, that from our research, from our expertise, we know is going to have a positive impact on communities and students, we have to, what Dr. Karen Mapp calls, dual capacity building. So we have to be able to build the capacity of families to understand why we need something, why we're advocating for it, of students to be able to have a voice. It's not just enough to say, I want student voice, let me pull and do a focus group for some kids. They'll tell you what they want, but you might also get like, we want longer lunch, we want Cheetos in the vending machine. And then they might give you some really good stuff too. But we've got to build capacity. And so one of the biggest things that I think about is like, have high expectations for your stakeholders. Do not say this is too technical, they can't do it. Bring them along. I have had, I do a really great session with another partner called data literacy for caregivers, or developing your, so that's a direct training for caregivers that I provide, or building your data literacy strategy to engage caregivers. That's for district leaders. So how are you thinking about your data maturity model and your data strategy? To be able to be inclusive of caregivers? How do you let them know all of the many streams of data and analytics that you bring on their kids? What should they be expecting? What's your assessment calendar look like? Should they send an extra snack with their kid to school that day? Like, how, what can they expect? And when can they, what data sets can they expect to come home, and how to engage with them? How to leverage them as instructional partners. So when they're at a conference, they're not just listening passively, they are engaging in a two-way discourse with educators and teachers, right? Or when they're at stake for losing accreditation as a school district, how do they engage with state politicians, political folks, to really advocate and push forward an agenda that means something to them as parents and as students? And so you're not the only one out there on the ledge by yourself. This is, there's a political, you know, impact to it. You're not the only one advocating for these changes. You have a whole community of stakeholders, and more importantly, voters behind you, who are going to be able to move forward a shared vision for schools that you know is necessary for kids.
Absolutely. Wow. And when you talk about, right, the data maturity model, the parallelization as you're building your data maturity model, now you're creating new value capture and creation for the education model and itself and the systems. And just to underscore a very, very important point, the individual that was building capacity with you belongs to the greatest fraternity in the world, Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. So that is a great father figure for you. Yes.
That's my dad. Yes. He's an alpha man, and he is definitely a servant of all. So that is where I get my servant leadership from, for sure.
Absolutely.
With a little finer spin.
But Dr. Bella, I want to underscore, right, when you were talking about organizing your strategy, building capacity, the data maturity model, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I want you to define in a very simplistic form, right, equity and innovation, and where can I start changing it, instructional systems for all based off of your aforementioned answers for the two previous questions?
Sure. If you're looking at this on YouTube, I'm in a school library because I love the children. They're not here today, but I'm in the library. And this is where it starts. It starts in the schools, it starts in the classroom, it starts in the instructional practice. I have to say this, Dr. Connor, and I have to say this loud and clear for all to hear. Mm-hmm. If your equity work does not start in teaching and learning, then you got to tell me what sector you're in. Because if you are in education, and educational equity is what you are pursuing, then it needs to be rooted in teaching and learning and instruction. And then if you are thinking about all the other ancillary agencies that we partner, collaborate with, health, food insecurity, housing, jobs, great. But if We are not talking about teaching and learning what the child will be able to do, knows what to do, et cetera, can demonstrate. We're not talking about educational equity. And so I have to tell people and I have to implore folks to know their practice, be a student of instruction, of high quality instruction, because any conversation outside of that suggests one of two things. Suggests that you don't think that every child can learn and achieve at high levels. And you and I are evidence of that, right? We are Black children, little Black kids, talking about some real smart stuff right now. But we didn't start here, right? Like, I might have been smart Alec. I might have had a smart mouth. But I learned it. I learned how to be this level, to know this. And every child, Black or otherwise, can. And so we have to have good instruction, and we have to have leaders that know how to lead it, know how to set the conditions, ripen the conditions for it. So when we talk about data maturity, there are these different stages, right, of your data maturity model, you know, that will tell you the diagnostic, the descriptive, the prescriptive, right? What are we hoping the data is going to point us in the right direction to move? There are different ways, but if you don't know how to collect that data in the classroom, if you don't know, a lot of people are leaning into street data and satellite data and all of this data on the ground, and that's wonderful, but we need to know now what? What do we do once we get information? Now, how does our practice change? How do we build communities of practice to examine our data, examine student learning? How do we bring kids along to be leaders in their learning? That's culturally responsive teaching. That's building a sense of belonging. And so those are some of the like really boring, unsexy equity conversations that's like, oh, you're talking about instruction again. And I'll say this last thing. It's not the last thing, but I'll say this last thing on the point. When I begin having conversations about instruction, it doesn't matter the identity, the ethnic or racial makeup of the educator. If they are not comfortable with their pedagogical practice, if they're not comfortable with either content or their ability to really challenge children to learn and do deep learning, there is always this pivot from that conversation to, well, you know, but the structure, but the tests are racist, but the curriculum is racist. And I like to tell people, you know, Frederick Douglass learned in a one-room shack. So it's not the curriculum. It's the expectation. He expected that he was going to be read, and therefore he was. And so what I tell people is when we are challenging educators' identity as teachers, then that's where we have to unpack that work. We talk about identity as being a Black person, white privilege, you know, being a gender nonconforming person, sexual identity, all these other identities, but we need to help people unpack their educator identities. And what does it mean to be able to move children for whom they have been far from educational justice? And do you, teacher efficacy is a really big part. Do you really believe you can do it? If you do, then you will. If you don't, then you won't.
Yeah. No, Dr. Molly, you presented a lot in that, specifically around educators knowing who you are and how we had to navigate through the system, right? And I like to reference, and it's very controversial, Dr. John Abu, right? John Abu's work specifically talks about, you know, involuntary minorities versus voluntary minorities. And African Americans are considered involuntary minorities, so we had to forcefully assimilate to the mainstream culture. Mainstream culture is this batched industrialization within the system that we were educated in. Mm-hmm. And the thing that his theory, and it comes out, right? How do we navigate through these prescriptive structures and systems, right? And Abu's theory goes to this identification we call fictive kinship. Fictive kinship is what essentially we have in quote unquote in the Black community, we had turned white. We had started to talk white, right? We forgot our home dialect. So this fictive kinship is more on the lines of we completely sold out who we were to be able to align to the mainstream. Now, that research presented a high level of controversy from all theorists, right, across the world. But when we think about now, this level of polarization and politicization in education, specifically, when we now have to understand and ensure that there's a high level of equity, educators knowing who they are, right? How do you unpack that as a leader? Because when we talk about this, right, there's some places you can't bring up the word race. There's some places you can't bring up the word equity. There's some places that Dr. Mullen cannot tell her story and her journey of how she got to where she is at the tables. Same thing for myself. But now, how do you break those barriers if we know those inhibiting factors exist?
Well, I want to double back to fictive kinship really quick because
Ooh, okay, come on, another geek session.
I think so. Here's the thing. I got excited because I think I came into that theoretical framework a little later into it, because there has been, and I've done a little bit of research, and this kind of answers the question in a roundabout way, a little bit of research around college persistence for students, right? College persistence, college attrition, and how does it work for like first gen students and Black students and dreamers and all of these other students that are marginalized in certain ways. And so fictive kinship came up as actually an anecdote to it. So being able, and then Katherine Lee has a book about kind of immigrants and fictive kinship and trying to keep families together through the immigration process. And the relationships that you make in very tumultuous and traumatic circumstances. And I don't know about you, I'm not a first generation college student, but for some of my peers and colleagues, it can be traumatic coming into a situation where you are the first and you're marginalized and you have no prototype for success for you. Being the first Black superintendent of a district, it can be a traumatic experience, right? In a community that there's no prototype. And so you look for these fictive kinships, as Katherine Lee has defined them, to carry you along, to be your family, because your own family has not gone there before. And so that's where you actually have, that's what we keep coming back to our Greek, right, families, because those are our fictive kinships that we've created to sustain us in this like very wilderness land that we've never experienced. And so back to your question of thinking about sustaining in the work and thinking about how do we press against these two identities that we have to carry. Paul Lawrence Dunbar is another poet whose work I often reference when I talk about being a woman or a Black woman or a Black person in these new frontier spaces that we're trying to diversify. He talks about the duality, and we wear the masks, right? We wear the mask that hides our eyes, shades our hearts, and grins and lies. And it really is about how you have to have this code switching. But your kinships, building that community of people where you can let your authentic self come through sustains you. It sustains you in the work. And then it also gives you permission to slowly but surely bring your authentic self to the field. I stand, on the shoulders of women who had to wear straight hair. Right. Like I have read, if you're listening, you can't see, I'm going to do my accessibility description, but I have red and Black braids, right? Like braids in my hair. That was never a thing. I have a nose ring. Like, any given day, my arms rolled up, you might see a tattoo. Like these are all things that millennial Black women would be like, you will never get a job and be taken seriously if you can't do those things. But because we started to create those kinships, we started to really have conversations about the context and the work in a real way and see changes, we started to give ourselves permission for us to bring our authentic selves to the space and sustain it. And then the next wave, Dr. Connor, of what happens is then we give our students permission to bring their authentic selves to the space and have those conversations that are very difficult because we know we have those kinships behind us, I guess, which is kind of the next iteration of that theory.
Look, I mean, wow. I mean, this is why I love talking to you, Dr. Mullen, because we get to talk about data, analytics, big data and literature and theory. There's nothing better than that. But I want to underscore something with you, and we're going to talk later because I want to get into that fictive kinship conversation with you outside of the podcast. But just for time purposes, right? Being the first, I was the first Black superintendent for my district. Obviously, going into that space, there is a level of trauma, and then because the low levels of understanding of being a Black man superintendent walking into a central office that did not have not one African American or brown person there. So, that's a really heavy lift for somebody. But when you see the Dr. Mullins of the world, when you see the Dr. Tracy Davises of the world, right? You see women that are shattering, right? Shattering glasses for other Black and brown females, as well as, you have Black leaders out there. When you have the Bob Runcies of the world, what he experienced, right? When we see some of what the superintendents are experiencing across the country, Black superintendents as well. We're building a strong foundation for the next level of leaders. Now, what I'm talking about the next level leaders is Generation Z and Generation Alpha. By the time Generation Z and Generation Alpha, right? Generation Z represent 48% of Black and Brown students. Those are our high school seniors, first year of college, all the way down to about grade five. Grade five is Generation Alpha, where 50% are Black and Brown, and one third of that generation come from non-traditional households. So by the time they come up and become the leaders, the next leaders of the world, we've already created that foundation, the shoulders, right, for them to carry on, right? So now when you think about that, we're seeing that the education entities are becoming more diverse, right? You see that there's a strategic focus on how we can lament equity and justice work beyond the BC stage of education. But culturally responsive, right? Culturally responsiveness is becoming more of, I like to say, education fad. We like to say that we're doing it, but in reality and practice, we're not seeing the academic, social, operational return on investment via qualitative or quantitative metrics, let alone seeing the system change in itself. But as a leader starting this journey to democratize equity for Generation Alpha and Generation Z, where now you, Dr. Muller, are setting the next level shoulders for this generation to be successful, how can you build a coalition of shoulders, you, women like Dr. Tracy Davis, right? How do we now build those shoulders where we can start reimagining the model to be culturally responsive and set up Generation Z and Generation Alpha for success?
So I love to think about intergenerational work. And I work with an organization, a youth leadership and youth development organization in Rhode Island, that is solely around, right, youth voice, youth leadership. And I love to think about intergenerational spaces. Hate to keep bringing it back to the Greeks, but that we're a prime example of that, right? We're all 100 years old, just about. And we could easily be sitting in a meeting with somebody who is almost 100 years old. Like they could literally be in their senior twilight years. And I have found so much value in sitting at the feet of my own grandparents who are no longer here, but I learned a lot from them. And then also just sitting at the feet of elders in my community in any space. And so we have to, one, continue to create spaces where there are intergenerational conversations. So it's not an and, that you talk about traditional families. The traditional family structure could be a mom, a nuclear mommy, daddy, whatever, dog, but that is not, for many reasons, what families look like. But the thing that actually makes the most, there was just some research that came out from AARP. I mean, they're not a good research body, but this is what it is, that children who grow up with grandparents in their lives achieve higher, have a stronger sense of identity, a sense of self and self-esteem. And so It doesn't have to be your meemaw and pawpaw. It could literally just be an old person down the street. It could be a person at your place of worship, your faith, like, you know, a senior that you go visit on the holiday. So creating opportunities, it could be what we like to do in some of our districts, like books with seniors or a senior prom, right, where you go and the seniors in your high school go and dance with the seniors at the community center. So creating any opportunity, if you have an improvement community, like you're doing steering committee for your school improvement dollars, go grab some of them seniors, child, because they was here for the last seven superintendents and they could tell you exactly what happened. Go grab them and bring them into spaces with your youth to have intergenerational spaces, because one of the things that is that, you know, grandma says is there's nothing new under the sun, and there isn't. It just looks very different. So when we talk about equity and innovation, we also have to think about coherence and innovation and understanding context. Understand why the fence was built before you go and knock it down in the name of equity. Right, because it may be have it might have been keeping something in that you don't have the institutional knowledge to understand why it's there. It may not be the best fence, and it may even be creating barriers, but learning that context, so that intergenerational space will provide context. Youth and children have the fire, they have the fury, and baby, they got the energy. Okay, they can keep going, but they don't have the context.
Right.
So being able, that's why your auntie and them said keep on living, because you have to get the context. And I've learned that, right? But I also know that youth have an expertise and a voice and an eye to the future, because by the time you're there, it's not, you know, you've already it's already there, you know, you're too late. So we have to engage youth in a meaningful way, in Generation Alpha, in a meaningful way. But what I have found, the short point is that we haven't built their capacity to engage. And that's what the intergenerational space is for. That's what the intentional capacity building, having youth development programs like Girl Scouts, like 4-H, like, you know, some of those other youth organizations that are serving Jack and Jill of America. Even some of our own, you know, organizations have youth programs. Whatever you can to have strategic partnerships. You don't have to do it all as a school district, right? You don't have to take on that after school. There are communities in your, there are organizations and nonprofits in your communities that are willing to do the work. They want to work with youth all day long. But if we strategically partner with them, like a Breakthrough or other orgs, if we partner with them, not only do they have insight into districts' vision, goals, values, where we're trying to take kids in those 6.5 hours of the day, they can do some of that social, emotional, dispositional, self identity, racial identity work that we simply don't have the time to do it because we're teaching ABCs and 1, 2, 3s. So they're going to be taking that work in the out of school time space. And then by the time we look up, those kids are primed and ready to, guess what? Come back into the buildings as teachers, as leaders, because they've seen us. They're like,
Absolutely.
man, Dr. Mullen was here. She was there on the ground with us, telling us we could be what we want to be. I think I want to be a superintendent. Yeah, baby, you do, because I ain't going to be doing this forever. So come on.
Now, Dr. Mullen, all right, this is great, right? And student voice, agency, and engagement. I love the intergenerational grouping. And when you think about how you were, aligning it, right? I mean, that's the strategy. That's the setup for success for our babies, as you're saying. But last question, and I
Yes.
know it's going to be hard for you
I'm
because
gonna
it's
try to be brief.
me, right? So one of my mentors, when we talk about shoulders, Dr. Reginald Mayo, he always said, you got to limit it to 3 B's. Be brief, brother, be brief. So now this question, I love that, right? So I love that. So now this question is very hard for all educators, but I want you to do this, try this the best that you can. In only 3 words, in only 3 words, what do you want to leave as a lasting point for leadership with all of the participants here for today's episode? 3 words.
Heal, HEAL. Listen and speak.
Absolutely.
That's it.
It's kind of like my book title, Intentional, Bold, and Unapologetic.
Right.
But Dr. Mullen said, we gotta heal, we gotta listen, and we gotta speak up. And we have to keep that in mind, right? Because the only way that we can be able to be the leaders, the equity driven, the equity focused leaders, we have to understand that, self-care is important. Self-care is important. Listening to our constituency and then speaking for them through the work. So, Dr. Mullen, I will be seeing you at the New York Leadership Forum, right? So we're going to have a great time there, and looking at how we can disrupt assessments intentionally. So that's going to be very, very provocative. So looking forward for you and your participation in that. But Dr. Mullen, more importantly, for the Voices for Excellence episode number 4, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart, sister, friend. It is just absolutely an honor to have you here today.
Thank you, Dr. Connor. I'm so excited to have been four. So thank you. That is wonderful. It's such a great time.
Absolutely. And I look forward to seeing you. You will be able to see Dr. Mullen, who will be at the 50th annual NAPSE conference. So please, if you see her, pick her brain, pull her aside, email her. She'll even give you her telephone number to text her because that's how important leadership is to her. So thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I look forward to seeing you at the next episode. Onward and upward, everybody. Have a good night.